Hello, everybody. The good news is that on Friday night, Sale beat the reigning Premiership and European champions, Exeter Chiefs, by 20 points to 20. The bad news is it took us 86 minutes to actually seal the win, despite the Chiefs being down to 14 men for the last 60 minutes of the game. My name is Lewis. Welcome back inside the Shark Tank. And joining me to make some sense of what was a pretty crazy game on Friday night are my co-hosts Alex and James. Alex, how are you?
Heart rate is just about recovered from last night. Thanks, mate. It was a stressful one, and there was a little bit of shouting at the telly, but we got there in the end. So I think having slept on it, I'm quite happy with the result. How are you?
Yeah, much the same. I think in the cold light of day, you realise what a triumph it is to beat Exeter in any circumstances. But I think on the evening of Friday, you know, a couple of gins at the end of a long week, you know, you're thinking this is the worst game I've ever seen, and Carl Dixon and Ian Tempest are not very good referees. So I think we've all calmed down a little bit, which is why we're doing the podcast on a Saturday morning, and we can actually bring some proper analysis and slightly less sale bias to it. James, how are you?
Yeah, I mean, just as Alex said, really, the heart, it's not good for the heart, is it, watching Sale? Sometimes I think maybe I care too much, and for my mental well-being, I should step away. But something just keeps drawing us back, doesn't it? Because at the end of the day, it's good entertainment. And I'm just really pleased that we got the win.
So let's kick things off there then, Alex. You know, as we've kind of mentioned off the top, it's a win over the reigning double champions. You know, it puts Sale back into the top four for today, at least. We're recording this Saturday morning, as I mentioned. You know, it on the face of it, it's, you know, it's a really good win. How do you temper that with the fact that Chiefs were down a man for 60 minutes and actually the result maybe should have been a foregone conclusion much earlier?
Yeah, I think if you're a side aiming for, you know, sneaking into the top six like we were 2-3 seasons ago, I think this is a great result, and you just take the points. And I think the mindset change has to be we're a side that wants to be in the top four, and we should have got a bonus point win out of this. And, you know, we can sit here as fans and kind of worry about the performance, which I think is kind of my key issue with it. You know, the actual performance there wasn't good. I think there were very good moments, but Sanderson talked about an 80-minute performance. Well, you know, we probably played less time of the game at our peak than we did against Quinns, because against Quinns, you know, we were building pressure for a lot of the time, and then it was just a crazy 10 minutes. With this, I think, you know, we were playing 14 men for 40 minutes, and we weren't able to build pressure. We were the ones under pressure. And, you know, for them to have a chance to win the game right at the end, and to be for that to be kind of, you know, taken away from them with a controversial call, which I don't think it's fair to kind of, you know, I think it's fair to say it was controversial. And if it had happened to us, I'm sure we'd be up in arms about it. I think just points to the fact that, and I said it last night, this squad doesn't deal well with the favourites tag. And if you want to be a top four side, you've got to be able to deal well with the favourites tag. But we have such an underdog mentality that when we go 15 versus 14, we just lost our heads again, I thought. You know, we weren't looking to play the space. We don't have that confidence to say, okay, we're going to throw it wide. And, you know, they've taken a winger off for their centre-off man. And we just did, you know, we were having people running into Exeter's, you know, close defence. So I think I've kind of covered loads of bits there. But I think my overall concern is, yes, it's a great win. It's beating Exeter. I'll take that every day of the week. It was a needed win after two losses on the bounce. But the concerns and the performance are still there. And frankly, we should have won that game, because even before the game, Exeter weren't in great form. And then they played 50 minutes of it with 14 men. So we absolutely should have won the game. And to be honest, we should have got a bonus point, and it shouldn't have been reliant on a controversial or, you know, somewhat dubious call at the end, which went in our favour. I think that's the frustrating thing.
Where do you sit on that then, James, in terms of kind of how we measure this performance up against actually, you know, what should have been, well, not an easy win, but a win given the circumstances?
Well, I think we would have lost the game if Exeter had had 15 players, especially if that 15th player is called Facundo Cudero. I was very happy to see him taken off because he can score tries from anywhere. So I think we would have lost. That said, you know, we went into the game with two previous losses. You know, our confidence wasn't in a great place. We knew if we lost this one, then especially with our first choice side out, we could have been in quite a bit of psychological trouble. But then it always happens, right? The opposition lose a player, and unless you're already ahead on the scoreboard or you can get more than one score ahead, usually from that point, the teams that have 15 players usually then run away with it with quite big scores, because the opposition just mentally know they can't come back from more than one score behind. What we found with both the Wales games in the Six Nations, but then also with the Sale game last night, is if you're behind on the scoreboard already and you just don't get that score going for you and you can't get ahead of the game, the pressure comes onto you. The pressure's on you. You're expected to win. The players know it. And then you get unforced errors. And I thought we saw, you know, a fair amount of unforced errors yesterday, last night. That said, I do think that there were some outstanding individual performances. You know, there are definitely some players that have picked up this new Sanderson era and have gone out there and they really put in some, you know, an excellent individual performance. As a team, we're still not clicking. We haven't really done for over a year now.
So let's pick up on that then. So I think from our side, the frustrations are apparent. The constant pick and goes, even with Exeter down a man in the back line. The sort of unforced errors, you know, I thought Dan Dupree had a pretty tough game in that regard, a couple of knock-ons in the 22. You know, things like red zone efficiency and points from opposition entries into the 22, pretty low for Sale. You know, we really do struggle to convert those opportunities, you know, when we're trying to build pressure. Ironically, you know, it's kind of the anti-Exeter approach. We're so good at that. So I think obviously, you know, those things are our main frustrations. But you want to talk about individual performances that actually maybe kind of propelled us past the systemic issues that we're facing at the moment, James. So, you know, who stood out for you? Who kind of rose above the fray in your perspective?
Well, Luke Diaga got man of the match, and for 60 minutes he was titanic. I actually thought he tired in the last 20 minutes, and I thought he was fortunate to get man of the match, because I thought that man of the match was quite clearly Curtis Langdon. He played 80 minutes, and he got stronger as those 80 minutes went on. You know, his influence on the game raised, his energy levels didn't drop, he was still putting tackles in the last phase play. And of course, you know, to be fatigued and to have the awareness to step the way he did to the line and score the try that he did, he for me, it was his best. I mean, he's had some good ones since July, Curtis Langdon, but that was his best performance in a Sale jersey. In fact, it was probably the best performance of his career, you know, probably. At 23 years of age, you know, he's now looking like a Premiership starter, isn't he? And it's difficult to say that Aka van der Merwe's form since July warrants getting ahead of Langdon's overall form. He had a poor game a couple of games ago, but he came off the bench last week and made an immediate impact. And generally, his form has been very good. So I think for me, Curtis Langdon was exceptional, the best player on the park. Cam Neill put in another brilliant shift in the back row, playing out of position at seven. Was enough of a threat, I thought, over the ball this week to stemmy Exeter and slow them down. And Exeter did a lot of gameplay behind the game line. You know, I think that's partly slowing the ball, and it's partly, you know, his tackle technique was excellent. A lot of people obviously caught, and I know that Alex will want to talk about maybe Jono should have come off instead. Possibly Jono obviously had a, you know, he obviously tackled his heart out as always, but he was completely brain dead for the whole game, and I can understand why. But actually, Cam did look knackered when he came off at 61 minutes. I thought Sam Dugdale's extra legs probably did help us see us through. So, yeah, I've got Langdon, Luke Diaga, Cam Neill as the kind of the ones that I really, really want to sort of single out. And clearly, Bevan Rodd continues to show that, you know, just with time and experience, he's probably going to play for England.
Luke Diaga is so good. Such a good player. And I said this, I think it was to Alex last night, but you don't realise a player's kind of world-class ability until you see them just execute at an above average rate in every facet of the game. And I thought Diaga, his tackling was fantastic, his carrying was fantastic, his clear outs of the ruck was fantastic. He was throwing, you know, passes out the back of his hands at certain points, you know, didn't lose a line out, etc., etc. And, you know, he was that kind of central figure in the pack that, that maybe we haven't had, really, that someone who can just execute in many different ways. I mean, Dan Dupree was probably our player of the season last year, you know, but there are certain things he doesn't do particularly well. Like, he's not a grunt, you know, a grunt guy. Doesn't do the sort of, you know, the real nasty stuff. Well, he does do the real nasty stuff, but that's a different conversation. But basically, you know, Diaga, the kind of impact he brought in the middle of the pitch in a really abrasive game as well, I thought was a key difference, and certainly one of the reasons why we're able to eke out the win. And obviously, yeah, Bevan Rodd, Curtis Langdon, Cam Neils, some of these, you know, the young English, you know, not all of them have come through the academy, but the kind of academy lads, you know, are making such a massive difference. And it's great to see that kind of trust and faith that Sanderson and the coaching staff are putting into them being rewarded. Because like you said, James, it was Langdon's best game of the season. Alex, we've spoken mainly about the forwards there, and obviously it was a very forwards dominated game. Did anyone catch your eye in the back line before we talk about maybe some less than ideal performances?
Yeah, I think Faf had a brilliant game, and I think probably he came off at the right time, I thought, because I think similar to Lude, his kind of effectiveness on the game maybe in the last, you know, from 60 minutes onwards was starting to, you know, starting to make a couple of mistakes. But I think generally he looked up for it. And you know, BT made a very good point, which is that when he's up for it and on it and looking like a world beater, it brings up the rest of the team because we kind of, you know, we rely on him so much. And he almost takes over the game. And I think, you know, that was really, really good when Exeter had 15. And had Exeter had 15, I think he would have continued being really important. And I think what probably sort of, the reason he actually needed to come off in the end is because, you know, we needed someone who could get it to AJ, who could then see the space. And I think that was particularly my frustration as a former back and former 10, that, you know, the ball wasn't getting out. You know, it was just being kept in the forwards. But I thought generally Faf had a superb game. His tap for the first try, just that's exactly what you want to see from him. The pass and the vision to see McGuigan on the wing was superb. You know, the way he was hitting defences, the way he was getting in Maunder's face. That's when you know he's you know, he's up for it and he's on it. And I think he ran the show a lot. I maintain that if Exeter had stayed at 15, he would have been even more important than he ended up being in the game. On that point, I thought Byron McGuigan had a good game. I think the way he kind of sniffs out tries and the way he gets himself into spaces is really good. There was a really nice pass from AJ, which was sort of Finn Russell-esque over about three extra players. And McGuigan just held his width on the wing. And I think, you know, he's someone who is really, really solid. And when he's on, he will probably score a try. And he is also really effective. So I thought he had a great game. And then I thought Luke James again, and I think we always miss out Luke James because he just does things so well and so brilliantly, but in a really understated way. But the way he beats defenders now, you know, he takes kickoffs and he takes high balls with such sort of, he's so commanding for a young lad. And then he shrugs off defenders and gets ahead of his own ball carriers again so that we retain the ball. And that is, you know, that's what Simon Hammersley is not doing at the moment for me. He's not quite getting ahead of his own players to then recycle the ball. And I think Luke James is just an absolutely superb player. And he is a 15 for me now. I don't think he's a 12. I think he's a 15. And I think he's a brilliant one. So I thought he had another superb game. Just really, really calm and mature for such a young lad. And he is going to be such a good player for a long, long time.
Can I just say on Luke James that, yeah, you're absolutely right. He beats the first man. Yeah, he doesn't have the top end speed, but what he's added, he's got really nice little footwork and he's slippery. And we saw that when he, you know, started his career at both 12 and 13. He slips through the first tackle, a bit like Will Greenwood used to do in the centre. I still think he could move back into the centre later in his career, especially, you know, we know he's not blessed with high-end speed now as he gets bigger and he gets older and his pace slows a little bit. You know, he might move back into the centre. But for now, he's definitely easily our first choice 15, like by quite a considerable distance. The other thing I liked about him as well was not only does he then, like, we never lose possession. He's never turned over. We always recycle, partly because he gets beyond people. But also he never drops the ball in the air. I mean, we haven't seen him drop a high ball for months and months. And then the other thing he's started to do is offload. He did about two or three offloads, which is not, you don't see that often from fullbacks. So the awareness he has and the time he has on the ball is fantastic. So no, I thought he had an excellent game. Good shout, Alex.
And let's give a little bit of love to AJ McGinty as well, who I thought had a really good game on his birthday, no less. I think it's very difficult to attribute these things back to certain elements of training or whatever, but the difference we've seen in AJ's kicking out of hand since Warren Spragg came in and replaced John Collard, there does seem to be a bit of a connection there. We're seeing, you know, slightly more varied array of kicks coming out of the pocket at 10. You know, we saw some really nice nudges across field, and I thought Sale did a pretty decent job of targeting Josh Hodge, the young Chiefs fullback, who had a pretty tough game, I think. But, you know, we saw that kind of come from AJ a couple of times. We saw the little loops over the top, you know, to set off Sam James or Byron McGuigan. Some of the passing looked pretty good as well, as Alex has already mentioned. And I thought, you know, McGinty had a really good game overall. I just think, you know, and this is kind of the next thing I want to discuss is, you know, when you have the AJ show and go on his birthday, his trademark move, disallowed for what is, in my opinion, a pretty poor call. But James, I want your opinions on it. I mean, that is just highway robbery of the first degree. I mean, let the man do his show and go on his birthday. But I thought, you know, let's talk a little bit about those refereeing decisions. You know, James, AJ obviously had two tries ruled out. I mean, you know, where did you stand on both of them?
I thought they were both tries. I mean, the first one was obviously an individual. It was the only mistake Cam Neill made in the whole game. But, I mean, we should have scored way, way before that. I mean, I know that just to pick up on the kind of Faf-AJ axis, Faf he's a brilliant rugby player, but what he lacks is, you know, he's almost too dominant. And they showed that graphic with all the playoff nine. He should have made the decision to be passing out wide a lot earlier. But because he doesn't, McGinty needs to get a lot more fucking in his face. A lot more in his face. He should have been screaming at Faf to get the ball out of there because they would have walked it in. We had a two or three man overlap on the right-hand side for about 4 or 5 minutes. So this wasn't kind of like, oh, you missed one opportunity. And Faf, they even looked. Faf was looking. He was looking past the fucking ball. Yeah, so I think part of that is the way that we've been told to play. When we're in the five, you're more likely to score by picking goes and latching on than by trying to pass it out wide, even with a two-man overlap because of individual error rush defences. Anyway, back to the two tries. That it wasn't a knock-on for my mind. His foot wasn't in touch and it was a really good grounding. And then the second one, I mean, I can't understand that. That was a ridiculous decision. There was no obstruction there. Didn't stop him making the tackle. The defender overran it. He was trying to come back through the player. That's why it looked like obstruction. It's not our fault they were doing a rush defence and he overran it. And the ball had already gone one further out. That's why he was turning around. And the player was always already in, like, you know, with the ball in front of him. He was never going to make that tackle. So, no, that was a ridiculous decision. And actually, that nearly lost us the game, really, because I think at that point, you know, we probably would have gone on and got a losing bonus point because that would have brought us back. So, yeah, that's my view. What about you, Lewis?
Well, I mean, I think I tweeted something about how it's one of the worst calls I've ever seen, and I think it is. You know, I just don't know how you can call that obstruction on Ollie Devoto because you're absolutely right, James. He's overran it. And I'd be saying that if it was the other way around. You know, I genuinely, this isn't Sale bias coming through. It's just McGinty made a brilliant step to go through the gap because the Exeter defence had overcommitted. You know, and if we're calling those obstructions, it just means that the set play where you go out of the back and dummy runners are used to go in front of the ball should be obstruction every single time. If you follow that law all the way to its logical conclusion, it just means, you know, you can't use dummy runners anymore, because them being in front of the ball in theory prevents any sort of tackle. So really, really poor decision. And actually, I think at that point, if we'd scored that with sort of 10, 15 minutes left, I think it ends up being a very different game. And I think we'd probably go on to get the bonus point, because at that point, the heads start to drop. But as Alex mentioned a couple of times last night, you know, when you're playing a team like Exeter, you need those 50-50s, you know, to go your way. And for a big part of the game, they didn't. However, Alex, there was one that absolutely did go our way, and that was the Jack Yandle red card. You know, what were your thoughts on his sending off? And, you know, do you agree with Ben Kay that actually there should have been some mitigation there?
Well, I think that one's not 50-50, is it? You know, it was a red. If you're going to apply the law the way it's been applied, and I think Rob Baxter spoke really well on this after the game, you know, you sign up to the laws at the start of the season, and they are the laws you play by. And under those laws, it's a red card, because his arm wraps too late for me. And I think it's direct contact, shoulder to head. Langdon, you know, in terms of mitigation, Langdon isn't over the ball jackaling. You know, Yendl's not trying to clear him. He's already been moved away. So if he's trying to clear him with his shoulder. And what happens is Langdon gets moved by, I think it's Devoto, but I can't quite remember. But Langdon gets moved by someone, which means that Yendl hits him, you know, square in the face with his shoulder. But even if Langdon wasn't being moved away, Yendl's still coming in with a shoulder to move him out. That's why he's late to the wrap. So that one for me was absolutely clear red card. And I think, you know, what's frustrating is after all that chat last weekend, the fact that there's some debate about that as a red card is baffling to me, because it just is. It's direct shoulder contact to the head without wrapping. So under the framework, it's a red card. You can go and have the argument about the framework separately, but the framework is the law you sign up to at the start of the season, you know. And again, Rob Baxter put it really well, that, you know, you don't break the law. So, you know, you might not like the law. So we all might not like that we can't go and see our family indoors, but we do it because it's the law. Similarly, people might not like that you can't smash your shoulder into someone's head at a ruck, Jack Noel particularly, but it's the law. So, you know, don't do it and get a red card if you do it. So that one for me wasn't, you know, there's no debate on that. And I think the fact, if anyone's trying to have debate, i.e. BT Sport Blunders, then it just shows a complete lack of appreciation. And the problem is you've got players who played when that kind of thing was allowed and therefore are going, oh, it's really harsh on the players. You know, irrelevant. The laws are harsh on the players. It's a bit harsh that we can't pass the ball forward, but that's a fundamental part of the game. So, you know, for me, this is just, it's so black and white that I don't understand how you can have a debate on it.
Yeah, no, completely agree. And I think, again, when you see someone come in at pace, shoulder to head, no mitigation, given that Langdon's already been cleared off the ball, it is a clear red card. And I think, you know, there's no argument against that. If it's a red card for Peter Omani and Xander Ferguson, you know, in the last couple of weeks, it's a red card for Jack Yandle. Obviously, Sale then kind of went on, you know, to become the heavy favourites, and we've already spoken about the kind of mental effect that had. But actually, whilst we're talking about discipline issues, James, you know, I think we have to have a conversation about John O'Ross. Fourth yellow card in 9 Premiership games this season. Repeated offender throughout the game, you know, overrunning the ball and hitting the man in the air from a restart was what he got yellow carded for. But there was other instances, pushing players in the back, etc. I think it's really important to have this conversation. And, you know, as a Sale fan, you know, is your patience wearing thin for with the player that is supposed to be the on-field leader of the team?
Yeah, it feels difficult to have the conversation, because we know how many tackles he's made in a Sale shirt and how committed he is and how desperate he is to win. But there are two main problems here. I mean, before I get onto those two main problems, he should have been sent off. Should have been sent off. He had one yellow card, definitely. And then in the second half, there were probably 2 instances where he would have, at least for one of them, he would have got a yellow in normal circumstances. But because he'd already got another yellow, it wasn't even considered. And I think he should have been two yellows and off. And he'd lost his head. He was completely brain dead and lost his head throughout the whole thing. And we get his passion. I get that. But his and it's not just the yellow cards. It's just his discipline more generally. Just giving away penalties all of the time. Field position, silly places. And what signal does that send? Onto my 2 points. Onto number one, the team. So they'll be sitting down talking about discipline and how we need to keep that, otherwise we'll lose games. And then your captain is going out and getting yellow carded every other game. And he's giving away penalties all of the time. It just makes it look like he's losing his head and he's in a panic. It's not what you need. And then the second message he's sending, what message is it sending to referees, really? You know, I think there's different styles of leadership and managing referees, but I don't think we could ever say that Jono is kind of one of the referee club's favourite captains to deal with, because he's aggro. If he's committing offences, I think it's quite difficult for him to be going to the referee asking for mitigation for other players when there are infringements. I think he needs to... It might be just because he's knackered. He's played every game this season. There's been a lot of rotation, but not for Jono. But we are short in the back row a little bit at the moment with the Currys not available at seven. So it is putting pressure on him to play every week. But I wonder whether he maybe plays on the bench or something next week just to give him a break. You know, he's always going to play on the edge, but he's crossing the line at the moment, and he just needs to probably have a little... Be spoken to and told to go and relax, take some chamomile, and then come back ready.
Alex, where do you stand on kind of Jono Ross at the moment in terms of what he's bringing to the team and any potential drawbacks off the back of that?
Well, this is the thing. I think Jono contributes so much, and you know, 2 years ago, a year ago, was by far one of the most important players in this team. And was making a massive positive contribution with some minor discipline issues, and they were largely limited to penalties. Recently, last year, and particularly this season, he is contributing defensively still, but we've got to a point where our squad is now sufficiently talented that we don't just have to defend all game. So we have, you know, people have to have some kind of, you know, benefit in attack as well, which I don't think is his strength. You know, people pointed out that the moment where he takes it into contact rather than look into the three-man overlap he's got outside him. So I think that's part of it. But the other part of it, as James said, he should have been sent off last night. And if I was an Exeter fan, I'd be pretty, you know, I'd be sitting here relatively pissed off that he didn't, because, you know, he went across in a line out, which he did the other week, consistently, and so clearly hasn't learned. And you know, he was just making errors and discipline errors that are annoying the referee. And you know, I thought when I said the 50-50 calls went against us, I genuinely believe that there's an element of that Jono Ross is causing because of the relationship he has with referees. I don't think Ian Tempest likes Jono Ross in the slightest. I'm not saying that Ian Tempest is a biased referee, but I do think that subconsciously Ian Tempest sees Sale and thinks of Jono Ross, understandably, and then thinks, well, it's that guy who gives me a load of grief all the time and is an utter pain in my arse and is an ill-disciplined. And so therefore, if there's, you know, is it like this side of maybe it deliberately obstructed for AJ's try? Oh, well, maybe it is. And I just think it's a massive issue. And James is right. It's a massive issue with referees. It's a massive issue with the squad. It's a massive issue for my heart rate because I sit there for 50 minutes thinking he's going to get sent off and we're going to get down to 14 and throw this away. And, you know, we just can't afford it anymore. And I think that's the point. His net contribution now is down to a negative because all the benefit he brings in defence, we could get from someone like Cam Neill or Sam Dugdale, but they don't make the errors and they don't have the discipline and they don't get sent off for 10 minutes virtually every game, which is where Jono is at now. And maybe he needs a break. Or maybe he needs to take a bit of responsibility off his shoulders or something. But he is playing at a level where he's going to get yellow carded every week because he is making, you know, he doesn't seem to understand the new set of laws and the kind of, you know, don't go in with your shoulder, don't take people out in the air, because other players can do it. So it's just really frustrating. And I think he's still a brilliant player and he still should play for us. And he's done absolutely loads for the club in a relatively short time. But at the moment, he is a liability and we have got players who I think are more deserving of that sixth jersey. And I think Cam Neill and Sam Dugdale both would contribute more at the moment overall. They might not contribute the same intensity in defence, but I think as an overall package, they're pushing to be ahead of him in the squad.
I think as well it's worth reiterating the reason why we're honing in on Jono Ross is that the standards are just so much higher when you are the club captain. There's nothing wrong with playing on the edge, and there are many brilliant players in the Sale squad and elsewhere who do play with that edge. But the point around kind of relationship management, especially with the referees, is so important. Because when you've got a team full of Jean-Luc Dupriers and Dan Dupriers and all these hard-nosed physical players who like to play on the edge, if you've got a captain who is setting the example that it's okay to push people in the back and give away silly penalties and take things too far, that does have a knock-on effect. And if you have four or five of those players kind of playing that way, you get a reputation with referees, which makes it difficult to win 50-50 calls. The best captains are the ones who are able to manage the referee as well as the game slightly. And nobody can fault what Jono Ross brings to the club. He's an absolutely fantastic squad member. He's a top four quality player. And he's someone who does have, you know, a massive place in the club. And I'm sure off the field, he's a fantastic sort of leader of men type. But on the field, we have to set the standards so high for him, because in terms of what he brings in his overall game, there are areas where someone like Cam Neill has the advantage, you know, for example, at the breakdown. And we have to be very careful of the template that he's setting the team to follow and the effect that that has on our ability to manage games and manage referees.
Yeah, and I think what I would also say on this is, it is like somewhat harsh to single out John. I mean, you're right, it's because he's captain, it's because of that relationship with the referees, which I think we need more people in the leadership group who can take over as captain and kind of build a better relationship with the referee group. Because I imagine our reputation in that group is pretty low at the moment. But what I also wanted to say is that we conceded 18 penalties last night, and 10 of them came from South African players. So Dan Dupriers conceded 4, Jono conceded 3, and then Faf conceded 1, Cobus Rees conceded 2, and Rob Dupriers conceded 1. So I don't know whether there is some kind of issue here. I'm not, you know, kind of highlighting that, but we have certain players, and I think it's more than Jono. I think the two Dupriers twins, similarly, concede a hell of a lot of penalties, and it is just not sustainable to be doing that. And I think, you know, it kills us. It killed us in this game, and it should have cost us the game, shouldn't it?
And the thing is, it's not like Ben Curry competing for the ball and getting done for having his hands on the ground, right? These are penalties that are fucking stupid. Excuse my language, yep, to everybody of school age. You know, there was that one in the corner that strikes me with Dan Dupriers just, you know, just coming in from the side. And it was just brain dead. Because he's got the physical edge, he just couldn't hold himself back from just continuing. There's just no sense in there. And that's what's frustrating when you give away stupid penalties like that. We've got them pinned in the corner, penalty, suddenly they're up to halfway with an attacking line out. You know, and when you've got an opposition playing with 14 men, get them to play their way out of their own 22. That's how you beat them, by just keeping the pressure on.
Yeah, and go back to last week, Jean-Luc Dupriers' yellow card. Quins are in their 22 under pressure, and you let them off. You let them off with a penalty and bringing yourself down to 14 men for the sake of clearing out a player who's doing nothing in that ruck. And then what's genuinely baffling is that after that Dan Dupriers one, we're going, I think it's Kearney Oosthuizen, who there's a caterpillar ruck at like the next play, which is about five people long, and he starts hitting it. And you're like, at what point do you think you're going to disrupt a nine who's got, you know, five players ahead of you when you've just given away a penalty for doing exactly the same thing? It's just nonsense. I don't understand why they think they... And that's a coaching issue for me. It needs people to say, when they're in their 22 and clearing the ball, let them. Because last night, and I forgot to mention this earlier, actually, I thought Raffy Quirk won the kicking duel against Stu Townsend in the second half in effect. Stu Townsend's kicking from box kicks was average at best. Raffy Quirk's was superb. He was putting them up. People were competing. And I wanted to make that point because people last week were saying, oh, Quirk can clearly do it on a fast pitch with an attacking kind of, but can he do it with a defensive and seeing out a game? And yes, he clearly can. But if we let Stu Townsend kick that ball away, it's not going to be a tough one for us to compete and take back. We were either taking them easily or they were going out into touch so it's just reading the game and understanding that, you know, how to build pressure. And I think that requires a level of rugby intelligence that I think the penalties are kind of synonymous with that lack of game intelligence and building that pressure on the opposition. Because all we do as a squad is we carry hard, we defend hard, but we don't think about the game, and therefore we build pressure on ourselves rather than the opposition, which is exactly what we did last night. We took a situation where we could have put a load of pressure on Exeter, and actually we just put it all on ourselves by giving away silly penalties, not using men when we had, you know, space out wide, and generally just kind of having a tunnel vision of, I want to go and find contact and I want to hit an Exeter player, when actually we need to get our heads up.
And that's why the game went to 86 minutes, because we had them pinned basically under their own post, penalty, line out, penalty, line out, penalty. And I thought, you know, we were going to throw this away, because we'd actually done the exact same thing for Sam Simmons' try earlier in the second half. As James mentioned, pinned them in the corner of the 22, in the coffin corner, penalty from Dan Dupria, penalty at the subsequent line out, they kick it to the 5 metre line and they score a try. It's brilliant when you can execute like that as the attacking team, but when you're the defensive team, it's a coach killer. And I think, you know, these are issues that we do need to see some progress with now, because our team, you know, I said this last night, John O'Ross is a fantastic leader for a team like a Worcester or a Sale a couple of years ago, where, you know, you're in the lower mid-table and you just need to get up for every game and you need to beat teams with hard graft and determination and work ethic because you don't have the talent. We've moved past that a little bit now. The team has talent, it has some money to spend, and we should be a better team. But we kind of have this underdog mentality, which is fine. But actually, you know, when you're playing against 14 men and actually on paper your team is just as talented as Exeter's, you shouldn't have to be resorting to, you know, grit and determination and all these other nonsense things to win games. You should just be playing heads up rugby, playing smart field position based rugby, and you know, making teams pay for having a man sent off after 25 minutes.
Yeah, can I just make one final point, just picking up what Alex said about rugby intelligence, game intelligence? I don't think he's having his best season ever, but I think it's the way we're playing. But Sam James, for me, is our most intelligent rugby playing back. And that's not playing... He does execute, phase play, you know, first and second phase play, attacking structural things really well. We've seen that in the past. But what he's really, really good at is reading what's in front of him and making a rugby decision, who to pass to, who to offload to. He's somebody who's played at the highest level at number 10, yeah? And he's played at 15, both decision-making positions. I understand that we want him further out, which makes sense when you're playing a wide game, because you want your decision-maker further out. We're not playing a wide game, right? So we need our best decision-maker, best ball player on the ball much closer to where the action is, which means that I love AJ, don't get me wrong, and he's kicking his goals, but we need Sam James at first receiver as much as we can, like upwards of 50% of the time. Move AJ further out in entire attacking structures. Faf needs to pass it to him and not run towards him 10 metres before he passes it, which sometimes does happen, but that's what I would like to see more of. And it could be quite an easy fix to some of our attacking issues.
And to that point, James, I think AJ has actually improved a lot in the last couple of years about playing heads up rugby and playing what's in front of him. And we saw a lot of that against Exeter last night. But going back to your point 20 minutes ago, when 80, 70% of all of your possession is being played off nine, it doesn't give AJ or Sam James the opportunity to, to actually, get the ball in the hands and make those decisions and stretch defences. We have one of the best scrum halves in the world, but we also have one of the most ball dominant scrum halves in the world. And that does have a knock on effect. And for all those sort of moments of brilliance and, Faf, creates as many tries as he maybe misses out on. What we need is an attacking structure in place that kind of reins that in a little bit and utilises it properly, because we are so decision-based around De Klerk and De Klerk's quick thinking that actually we miss three or four opportunities to spread the ball wide. Now, whether or not that's AJ or Sam James getting the ball at first receiver is almost irrelevant. What you need to do is make sure Paul Deacon or whoever else is building a structure that means we play off nine a lot less and get the ball to AJ or to Sam James and let them create the opportunities. And if we'd done that on Friday night, maybe we wouldn't have spent so much time talking about decision-making on the field.
Sorry, can I just make a final point on that before we move on? There's nothing wrong playing off nine a lot. Saracens did it all the time with Richard Wigglesworth and Ben Spencer. Just playing off nine, coming around the corner, really, really difficult to do. The difference was that Wigglesworth, when he needed to move it wide, moved it wide, and he made those decisions really, really well. And then, Saracens, they cut the teams apart out wide and scored lots of tries. But a lot of their ball was off nine. So it is doable. It's not to say that we can't continue to build a game around Faf. It's about decision making of when the going off nine has done its bit and then the opportunity is somewhere else. That's the difference.
And I do think this is being highlighted by the fact that last night we were against 14 men, and therefore, the natural kind of decision is to move it out wide. I think as a game plan, playing off Faf is absolutely fine, and I think it would have worked, and it's worked for us in the past against strong teams. It worked against Bristol. I'm thinking about that Saracens game when we beat them, that little run we went on when we beat Gloucester away. When we play off Faf, it does work. I think what we kind of need is that rugby intelligence and that flexibility to go, right, they are down to 14 men. We should move the ball out wide. And I think that's what we lacked last night. And I think it's the same thing we kind of come back to all the time, is that we are very good at being coached in a style of play and then executing it. What we are very bad at is when the game changes, kind of reacting to that change. And we saw it all the time under Dimes, in that we'd have a first half where we kind of were struggling and we just wanted to get into half time, and then we got into half time, we had a chat with them, and then we went out and changed our game plan and came back out better in the second half. And I think it just points to that the game changes, and playing off nine is no longer the best way of beating Exeter, which it was in the whole of the build up to the week. And we just don't kind of go, right, okay, and that switch doesn't flick and that communication doesn't happen in the team. And that's what we need. We need intelligent people like Sam James, like AJ, to go, the space is now out wide because they've taken a winger off. The space, where we can get dominance is no longer around the fringes and playing off Faf, which it was for the first 26 minutes. It's now moving it out to AJ and Sam James to put Yard and McGuigan away.
Well, it feels like we've collectively managed to build a bit of a game plan for Sale moving forward. So I guess that's probably where we should take the podcast next, which is Sale's next game, which is at home to Newcastle Falcons on Friday night. As always, I'm going to pass over to James, but it feels like we might have done a bit of the work for you this week, James, in terms of how Sale needs to approach this game.
Yeah, I mean, Newcastle are going to be a tough nut to crack, though. Dean Richards, as we know, when we did the Patreon pod on DOR candidates, he's an outstanding director of rugby, and he's doing a great job at Newcastle, and it's really great to see him. We don't want them to finish above us in the table, but genuinely it's brilliant to see a Northern club do so well. And based around a lot of young local lads, which I'll get onto, they did have a brilliant start They obviously beat us early season as well, and were flying high in the top four. They've lost a bit of momentum since then for a couple of reasons. First of all, they lost a couple of games to COVID, one against Tigers and then also last time out against Worcester. It's not all been the wrong direction. They have got some points out of that, but you know it probably has helped sort of stemmy some momentum and playing well. And then the other reason for the lost momentum is since the new year, they've gone on a run of bit of bad form, really. They lost away at Bristol, which, you know, nothing wrong with that. Away at Irish, which, you know, they probably would have expected to do better in. And then at home against Exeter in quite a dire game, really. They did win at home to Gloucester, but everyone's winning at home to Gloucester, you know, give or take. So they're not, I wouldn't say, in brilliant shape as a team, but they've not been far off in any of those games. They've not been uncompetitive. And I expect it to be a close game, whatever. They do have a big game for them today against Harlequins, who we know are in great form. So I think that seeing as we played Quins, you know, last time out, I think it's a really good benchmark for us going into this game to understand, you know, what a big task is going to be ahead of us. In terms of their squad, just two things I'd like to highlight, really. Firstly, is that they have got a really good core of homegrown players. Will Welsh and Mark Wilson continue to be unavailable. Wilson because he's playing for England, Welsh because he's missed most of the season through injury. That is a blow for them. It really, really is, from a leadership perspective, but also a back row perspective. Real dogfights when those two are playing. And at the moment, you'd expect them to get the upper hand on the Sale back row without the Curries. So we don't need to worry about that at the moment, which is a good thing. And of course, they've got McGuigan at hooker, who I think is a really good Premiership hooker. Good line out throw, really good scrummager, and a bit like Cowan Dickey, really dangerous close to the line with those kind of free kick penalties that you're getting at the moment. Really difficult to stop from 5 meters out. Sean Robinson, Chick, Hodgson, Radwan, Blamire as well. He's a sort of the second choice hooker, very dynamic off the bench. So watch out for him. You know, if the game does break up a little bit, he's pretty dynamic. And then the other thing that they've signed a few Argentinians. We seem to be the only team who's not been interested in the sad breakup of professional Argentinian rugby. But they brought in Matias Orlando, who can play at 12 or 13, really low centre of gravity. Really, really difficult to tackle and bring down. Doesn't have much of a kicking game, but really, really rapid over a short period of a short space of time. Can step off both feet, and I think that's going to be dangerous for us. Again, a bit like we had against Quins, and you know, like if he can get out the back, it is pretty dangerous. For Sale struggle with that, so Matias Orlando, I'm a bit worried about Matteo Carreras as well. Not in the same league as Santiago Carreras down at Gloucester, but again, small centre of gravity and absolutely rapid. He's on the bench this weekend. I think we might be seeing a bit more of him. Santiago Grondona is injured, badly injured, I think. He's not started a game yet for Newcastle, and he got injured in, after the end of the Rugby Championship. He's out for 6 months or so. So thankfully, we won't have to see him in the back row. And finally, to finish, just on my head-to-head, as always, the one I'm looking forward to is Luther Burrell against Sam Hill at 12. I think they've both got lots to prove. And of course, it's the Sale past versus present. So I think that will be quite an interesting matchup, Luther Burrell versus Sam Hill.
So, Alex, you know, we've obviously played Newcastle once already, and, you know, we spoke about it at length after that game about kind of where Sale went wrong, kind of just running into the Falcons' back row over and over again, not playing heads-up rugby, you know, not kind of using our attacking width and the opportunities that kind of arose from that. You know, it's 8 weeks later, we're still talking about the same things, I suppose. You know, from your perspective then, I mean, kind of knowing what we know about Newcastle and having played them already, you know, what's the formula for beating them?
Well, I think last time out, Newcastle came with a very, very fixed game plan, which was designed to target our kind of weaknesses. And a lot of that relied on Mickey Young at nine, who, as far as I can tell, is injured because he hasn't played for a number of weeks. They brought in the South African scrum half, whose name escapes me, Louis Schroeder, who is a good player, but is not in the same kind of mould of, you know, box kicking us to death. So I think that's part of it. And the other part of it is that last time we played Newcastle, they were really, really fresh. And that was part of the reason their season started so well, is because they hadn't played for a long time and they had a really good rest and came back with a good team in form. And they hit a load of Premiership teams who had a really long kind of back end of that season and then straight into another season. So I think that put them in a much better place and enabled them to execute that game plan they came up against us with. What I think should be better and should, you know, go in our favour this time is, you know, everyone's kind of at a more similar level now. Again, Newcastle have had a bit of a rest, so we'll be in a slightly better place than we are, having had no games lost to COVID. But we're probably a slightly more in that flow of playing professional rugby, and maybe it'll, you know, that'll work in our favour. But also, I think if they come to the AJ Bell with the same tactics that they tried at Kingston Park, you would hope that we are intelligent enough and can coach well enough in the week to neutralise those kind of tactics. And I think, you know, where Newcastle are dangerous is when they beat you up front, because they have got some exciting backs, Adam Radwan particularly, but I think they struggle with 10. You know, they are still, in the last few weeks, have been relying on Toby Flood. He's not playing this weekend. They've got Joel Hodgson, who's a very good attacking 10, but probably doesn't run the game as well. And Brett Connon, who is a decent 10, but, you know, not in the league of AJ McGinty, I think it's fair to say. And obviously, again, they've brought in Louis Schroeder at 9, who I mentioned before. So I honestly think that there is a massive opportunity for us here to really put Newcastle away if we play, you know, to the level that we are, A, capable of playing at, but even the level we started against Exeter last night. You know, that first 26 minutes before we ended up losing our heads going with them going down to 14. You know, we should beat them on paper. They haven't been playing well recently. They haven't created a lot. You know, they snuck past Gloucester. They haven't been in great form. They may benefit from the rest, but I think that we should have more than enough to beat them. What is dangerous, and I think what probably goes in our favour this time, is that Dean Richards is a very, very clever DOR who gets the best out of that squad. And I think hopefully it'll be a big test for Sanderson, I think, on how he works out what Newcastle are going to do and how to neutralise them. You know, they are so strong at home, and they are probably where we were 3 seasons ago, where they want to win the home games and they'll try and pick up a few wins on the road. And they might target us because they beat us at home. But I think, as a Sale fan, we should feel confident that we have the playing squad and the game plan to beat them. And I think if I was a Newcastle fan, I'd be quite worried about coming to this Sale team who look this strong on paper and actually have shown flashes. You know, we're coming off beating Exeter. We shouldn't forget that. You know, I know we've just had a 20-minute rant about all the weaknesses in this team, but they did beat Exeter at home. And I think that should be enough for us to be confident going into this Newcastle game. What I think the key is how Sanderson rotates, because if he does what he did coming off Bristol and brings in 10 new players, that's when Newcastle, who are a very organised team and, you know, very structured, will beat us, because we won't be as consistent as we should be.
I think this is an area where we should hopefully start to see the kind of development in Sanderson as a DOR and his kind of coaching strategy. Because actually, I think there's a relatively settled squad. You've just been in Exeter. You don't need to make wholesale changes. And actually, what you'd like to see is probably a little bit, as we mentioned before, less playoff nine. Because I think actually Newcastle are a team where if we can get the ball to our decision makers in the pocket at 10 and 13, there is opportunities, especially in the middle of the pitch. There's little kicks over the top where we can really start to stretch Newcastle's defence. What we struggled with at Kingston Park was that we played a very flat game and we kind of played into their hands a little bit. We tried to sort of muscle up front and we didn't really offer any sort of variety. I think Newcastle's centre partnership, for example, in Burrell and Orlando, they're not exactly the most fleet of foot, and that's an area where we can target. You know, you put these little kicks in over the top with players, you know, running onto it. And what that does is it also moves the Newcastle defensive line around a little bit because they're not having to just set up to take, you know, one out runners over and over again. So little kicks over the top. And actually another area where I'd like to see a bit more development is actually targeting Radwan and Stevenson in the air, because I think both are very talented players. But as is quite common with young wingers, you know, they're getting into the first team, not because they're really great tacklers. It's because, they're fucking rapid, right? So what you want to do is, early on in the game, you want to be hoisting kicks up, putting Radwan and Stevenson under pressure in their own 22, forcing them to make decisions about whether to, you know, call a mark or leave the ball to go out, etc., and put pressure on there. It's something we should have done at Kingston Park and we didn't. And actually, I think with the form someone like Marlon Yard is in, if McGuigan's playing, we showed against Exeter that actually our aerial attack is pretty strong. You know, we competed really well. And we can use that as a tactic to move the ball around the field. The more we can do that, the more it unsettles Newcastle's defensive line, and the more opportunities that actually then come off the back of that for someone like De Klerk to snipe around the edges or bring other people into it as well. So I think, you know, that's kind of where you want to see the development, because actually Newcastle aren't dissimilar to an Exeter. They just obviously don't quite have the same amount of on-field talent. So that's kind of how, what I'm looking for, at least, in terms of how we come out of that game and actually go to try and pick up another win against Falcons. Right, let's do some predictions. So, James, what do you reckon Friday night at the AJ Bell, Sale Newcastle?
Sale, when we never score more than 25 points, so 23, Newcastle 15.
I agree with that. I think our attack is still not quite there. So I will say Sale 20, Newcastle 6.
I'm going to go Sale 23, Newcastle 9. I think there is maybe not quite the firepower in the Newcastle team to really challenge us. And actually, if we can start to pad out the lead relatively early on, I think it should be a relatively comfortable win. Touch wood. So that's the podcast for this week. Thank you to everybody for listening. Thank you to Alex and James for joining me as always. From our side, I just want to announce there is some new features up on the Patreon. So obviously we have a playing squad tracker where we keep track of the entire squad and the contract status and the outlook for the next couple of years. Yesterday we've put live a new feature, which is a transfer tracker. So as every new signing, contract extension and departure comes in, those are also being tracked and updates being made to the playing squads for 2021, 22, etc. And as well, another feature for our patrons is that for every new signing and contract extension and departure, we'll be posting a series of short form articles on the Patreon, just analysing those moves. So the first three, discussing Tommy Taylor coming back to the club, Will Griff-John leaving for the Scarlets, and Marlon Yard re-signing his contract. And now up there as well, just some fun bonus content, so we can really sort of deep dive into those player movement and transactions where we might not be able to do so on the standard pod. So we really hope people check those out and enjoy them. And obviously, there's going to be additional pod-based content coming onto the Patreon soon as well. So that is everything from me. Alex, James, anything you want to mention before we sign off?
The only thing from me is, I'm not sure when we'll get this out, but good luck to Sale Sharks women who are playing Quins today. Hopefully they can do what the boys couldn't last week and beat them. That would be superb. I'm presuming the BT listeners have now dropped off by the end of the pod. So I do get a BT Sport match pass because I'm a Sale Sharks member, but I have a BT Sport subscription. So if any listeners for home games want my BT Sport match pass, just drop us a message on Twitter or email us at, what's our email, Lewis?
The Shark Tank podcast at gmail.com.
Yeah, drop us an email on there before a home game, first come, first serve. There will be a BT Sport match pass for all home games available. But yeah, good luck to Sale Sharks women against Quins is the main one. And don't tell BT that I'm showing my match pass, otherwise I'll get in trouble.